So if you sit in a completely silent room, the ambient noise of your own body, like your blood pumping, your nervous system firing, it actually creates this really faint, high-pitched ring.
Oh, yeah, the internal noise.
Right. And for most of us, our brains just sort of, filter it out. But for people suffering from tinnitus, that phantom noise is just deafening. I mean, it's completely inescapable.
It's always there.
Yeah, always. But what if that isolating, constant ringing wasn't a physical ailment at all? What if it was a memory?
It's a genuinely terrifying concept, really, because, I mean, if the noise is being generated by your own mind, there is literally nowhere you can run to escape it.
No escape at all.
Exactly. The quieter your environment gets, the louder the ringing becomes.
Welcome to your deep dive. If you are someone who is, just insanely curious about how music manages to capture the most complicated, contradictory human feelings, you are in the exact right place today.
We've got a really great one today.
We really do. We are taking a magnifying glass to the lyrics of a song called Rein Me In, which is performed by Sam Fender and Olivia Dean. And our mission today is to, well, essentially reverse engineer the songwriter's intent.
Right.
We want to unpick this track to understand how it functions as a dialogue between two completely opposing emotional coping mechanisms. We're looking at the raw mechanics of regret, isolation, and how people desperately try to outrun their own guilt.
And what makes these lyrics so compelling is that they totally refuse to give us a clean, simple pop music narrative.
Yeah, no easy answers here.
None at all. We're stepping into some really psychological muddy waters. You can't just neatly diagnose who is the villain and who is the victim here, because we're basically watching two fundamentally opposed ways of dealing with a broken relationship colliding in real time.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to really understand this collision, we have to look at the geography of regret.
The geography, yeah.
The song opens from the male perspective, and he does not bury the lead. He drops us right into this heavy confession of failure, saying, "I let go of everything I ever had because I couldn't give the love you deserved."
It's brutal.
It is. But then, almost immediately, that really broad sweeping confession narrows down to a hyper-specific physical memory.
Yes, and that shift from, abstract guilt to a physical location is just crucial. He anchors the trauma to a very specific place.
Right. He sings, "By the gunner, you shouted, 'Oh my God, it seemed churlish, but it's what I was owed, I suppose.'"
Yeah, and the gunner clearly serves as a local landmark, probably a pub. Psychologically, this is what we call environmental cueing.
Environmental cueing.
Yeah, the brain is incredibly efficient at mapping emotional distress to spatial awareness. So he isn't just carrying the memory around in his head. The memory is physically living on that specific street corner.
Oh, wow. And his reaction to whatever happened on that corner is just so revealing. He admits his behavior was churlish, which, means petulant, rude, sort of
Right,
childish.
he owns that part.
But in the exact same breath, he says, "But it's what I was owed, I suppose." Like, he knows he was the architect of the collapse, yet he's clinging to this, I don't know, this stubborn resentment.
Exactly. It's textbook cognitive dissonance.
How so?
Well, he's trying to hold two completely contradictory beliefs in his head at the same time. On one hand, I ruined everything, and on the other, I was somehow justified in ruining it.
Ah, I see.
Right, so to protect his ego from completely shattering, his brain just manufactures this excuse that his bad behavior was, just an inevitable tax the relationship had to pay.
But that excuse doesn't actually work, does it? Because the haunting only spreads. He goes on to describe how every flagstone of this town bears our prints, and all the bars around here serve my ghosts and carcasses.
The imagery there is just so dark.
It really is. The physical space of his entire life has become hostile. It's like walking through a museum where every single exhibit is just a glaring neon reminder of your own personal failures.
That's a great way to put it.
You try to go to your local bar to just like grab a drink, but they aren't serving beer anymore. They're serving up the dead, rotting remains of your past.
And that creates an intense claustrophobia. The environment is triggering him constantly. And that leads directly to the physiological response he describes next, where he says, "I wish I knew these things when I was young, because now I've just grown so numb."
Grown so numb, yeah.
We often mistake numbness for an absence of feeling, right? Like a sort of emotional void. But neurologically speaking, numbness is actually a trauma response.
Wait, really? It's active.
Yes, it's the nervous system hitting the emergency shutoff switch because it was being completely overwhelmed by too much stimuli. The town is so full of ghosts that his body has literally shut down its emotional receptors just to survive the walk down the street.
Wow. Which, you know, that brings up a really fascinating line right after that. He says, "We take whatever we can to get the reason back, so please don't rein me in."
Yeah, that line.
When I first heard this, I thought, oh, getting the reason back sounds, I don't know, somewhat noble. Like he's on a philosophical quest for logic, trying to figure out the root cause of the breakup so he can fix it. So, I mean, is he looking for clarity here?
Not at all. And that's actually the trap of the lyric. Getting the reason back is entirely a justification for his escapism.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. When you are surrounded by ghosts and your nervous system is shutting down, logic is the absolute last thing you want. Clarity would mean looking directly at the damage he caused.
And he definitely doesn't want to do that.
Exactly. Instead, he's looking for anything to restore his baseline equilibrium. He just wants to stop the panic. So the plea, "Please don't rein me in," isn't a joyous declaration of freedom.
Right. It's not like he's celebrating being single.
No, it is a frantic, desperate demand not to be stopped from fleeing his own guilt. He's terrified of what happens if someone forces him to stand still. Which makes perfect sense when we look at the central mechanism of his coping strategy. Because if his environment is hostile and his strategy is to just run, he inevitably needs a distraction.
He needs noise.
He needs noise. He sings, "I'm working myself up to a nice, warm bliss."
Right. And notice the effort involved there. Working myself up.
Yeah, it's active.
This isn't a natural state of relaxation at all. Mm-hmm. He is actively laboring to achieve this bliss. It really implies chemical alteration, drinking, substance use, or maybe just pure adrenaline-fueled, reckless momentum.
Just going as fast as he can.
Yes. He's trying to build an artificial, warm wall of sensory input between himself and the cold reality of those flagstones.
But that noise-canceling strategy has a fatal flaw. And here's where it gets really interesting, because why tinnitus? Of all the metaphors a songwriter could choose to describe a painful memory, why choose a phantom auditory condition?
It's so specific.
He says, "All my memories of you ring like tinnitus." It is arguably the most brilliant lyrical choice in the entire piece because of how tinnitus actually functions.
Yes. Think about it. If you and I are sitting in a room and I have tinnitus, I am suffering from this piercing high-pitched ringing. But you hear absolutely nothing.
Right. It's invisible to everyone else.
It makes the pain profoundly isolating because nobody else in the room can even validate it. The damage isn't coming from a speaker on the wall. The damage is inside the ear itself.
It's internal structural damage.
Yeah.
The memories aren't just sad thoughts. They are a symptom of an internal wound that just hasn't healed. And, you know, what happens with real tinnitus when you remove external noise?
It gets louder. The quieter the room, the more unbearable the ringing becomes, which honestly perfectly explains the stakes of his next line. He says, "If I stop, it's just pain. Please don't rein me in."
If we think about the imagery of reining something in, I mean, you use reins on a horse, right?
Yeah.
And usually a rider pulls hard on the reins to save the horse from doing something extremely dangerous, like galloping out into traffic or, you know, running off a cliff.
You pull the reins to keep them safe.
Exactly. But the narrator's perspective is completely inverted by his trauma. He firmly believes that the cliff, that frantic, self-medicated, chaotic, warm bliss, he thinks that is preferable to the pain of standing still.
Because standing still means silence.
Yes. If the person holding the reins forces him to stop running, the ambient noise of his life drops to zero. And the second it drops to zero, the deafening, isolating ringing of his own regret just takes over completely.
It's like when your car engine starts making a terrifying grinding noise.
Oh, yeah.
And instead of taking it to a mechanic to look under the hood, you just turn the radio up as loud as it goes.
Just ignore it.
Right. The louder the engine gets, the higher you crank the volume. He knows the car's breaking down. But he's actively choosing the danger of the distraction over the agony of actually listening to the broken engine.
That's it entirely. And, you know, this is exactly where the dynamic of the song fundamentally shifts. Because we've been living inside his head, surrounded by this internal ringing and his frantic need to escape it. But then the female perspective enters the narrative.
Yeah, Olivia Dean's vocal drops in. And it just completely shatters the solitary tragedy he spent the first half of the song building up.
It really does.
She steps in and basically challenges the entire foundation of his coping mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
Her opening line is, "There's nothing brave in walking alone."
What's fascinating here is that it's a surgical strike on his ego.
Oh, totally.
I mean, he has been painting himself as this haunted lone wolf figure, wandering the flagstones, surviving his ghosts, bearing the burden of his inescapable memories. He has completely romanticized his own isolation.
He thinks he's the tragic hero.
Right. It's a very common defense mechanism. The logic goes, if I'm fundamentally broken and cursed, then I am completely absolved of the responsibility to fix things.
Oh, that's so true.
But she looks right at that performance and says, no, that isn't bravery.
She calls out the false bravado immediately. And then she offers him an alternative, singing, love in exile has nowhere to go, so come on home.
Exile is such a strong word there.
The word exile is so potent, it highlights that he banished himself. He wasn't kicked out. He literally sprinted away from the scene of the crime.
He ran.
And then she just throws in on the actual root cause of his behavior. She sings, you're so afraid of that heart inside of your chest, and we were doing so well, but you were scared to be held, took the easiest way out.
She is playing the ultimate diagnostician here.
She really is.
She is looking right past the ghosts, past the crowded pub, past the complicated metaphor of the tinnitus, and she's identifying the core mechanical failure of his psyche. It's not a curse. It's just fear.
Just fear.
Wow.
He sings, I see the tears of a man too proud to reach for a hand, and then follows it up with, well, let my love keep you safe now.
Yeah.
But I'm curious about your take on this dynamic. When someone is in that spiral of self-destruction and pride, does offering unconditional safety like this run the risk of, I don't know, enabling them?
That's a valid question.
Is she just stepping into the role of the magical savior who is going to fix a broken man? Because it kind of feels like he's a knight wearing this heavy armor that's suffocating him, and she's just asking him to take the helmet off. But does that let him off the hook?
This brings up a really important distinction between empathy and enabling. I would argue her approach is profoundly disarming, precisely because she refuses to enable his delusion.
Okay, how so?
Well, an enabler validates the excuse. An enabler would say, you're right, the ghosts are too scary, the ringing is too loud, I completely understand why you have to drink and run.
Right, they would validate the radio being turned up.
Exactly, but she doesn't do that at all. She actively invalidates his excuses by naming the real problem pride and cowardice. She completely refuses to play into his tragic victim narrative.
Right, so using the car analogy again, she isn't offering to fix the engine for him while he ignores it. She's just the mechanic sitting in the passenger seat saying, hey, turning the radio up doesn't make you brave. It just means you're too scared to pull over and pop the hood. She's pointing out that the noise is a choice.
That's a great way to look at it. It reveals how these two voices are fundamentally mistranslating each other's reality.
Yeah, they're not on the same page at all.
Not at all. The male voice frames his isolation as a tragic, unavoidable necessity, like he is a victim of his own mind. But the female voice reframes it as a simple choice, driven by a very human fear of vulnerability.
And her proposed solution is the exact opposite of his instinct. I mean, he says, don't rein me in, meaning let me keep running wild so I don't have to feel. She says, let my love keep you safe now, which is an invitation to do the one thing that terrifies him most, to be completely still.
Which perfectly sets us up for the climax of the track.
Yes, the bridge. We have these two completely opposing forces, his panic flight and her clear-eyed plea for him to return. And in the bridge of the song, those forces just violently collide.
It is a spectacular collision, really. And it's where the performative nature of his grief is fully, finally exposed.
The lyrics in the bridge are just devastatingly observant. He sings, I'm stood here chewing everyone's lugs off. Telling everybody how much I fucked
that. Yeah, and chewing everyone's legs off.
He's standing in a crowded pub, just relentlessly talking their ears off about his regrets. He is loudly, publicly performing his guilt to literally anyone who will listen.
Let's really dig into the psychology of that, because it is so incredibly common. We have to look at the difference between shame and guilt and, you know, how we use other people to manage those feelings. Why is he doing this?
That's exactly what I want everyone listening to think about right now. I mean, why is it so much easier to confess our deepest, most profound failures to a bartender or a room full of total strangers than it is to look the one person we've actually hurt in the eye and apologize?
Because confessing to a stranger doesn't require actual vulnerability.
It doesn't.
No, it only requires an audience. When you sit at a bar and tell a stranger how much you screwed up, you are in total control of the narrative. You get to play the self-aware, tragic hero who is just heavily burdened by his own mistakes.
Oh, wow. You get all the credit for being honest without any of the danger.
Exactly. The stranger can't hold you accountable. They don't know the nuances of the pain you caused. They can only, you know, buy you another drink, offer some shallow sympathy, and validate your role as a tortured soul.
That makes so much sense.
It's a counterfeit vulnerability. He's substituting the hard work of genuine accountability with the easy reward of public pity.
Oh, that is brutal. counterfeit vulnerability.
Mm.
And the songwriter captures that exact realization with a repetition that just builds and builds. He goes, telling everybody how much I fucked it up, telling everybody how much I fucked it up, telling everybody but you how much I fucked it up.
That but you is the turning point.
That but you is the absolute dagger. It's the moment of ultimate tragic irony. His loud public confession is actually an act of supreme private cowardice.
He is basically using his public declarations of guilt as just another form of that warm bliss we talked about earlier.
Another distraction.
Yes, another form of auditory masking. As long as he is busy talking about how sorry he is to everyone else, he is generating enough noise that he doesn't actually have to face the quiet terror of apologizing to her.
And this all culminates in the vocal arrangement at the very end of the bridge, which is honestly a masterclass in using musical structure to tell a story. You have the two vocals overlapping, singing over each other at the exact same time.
It's chaotic.
It is. The female voice is repeatedly, calmly urging, slow down, slow down.
Hmm.
While the male voice is frantically, simultaneously pleading, don't rein me in, don't rein me in.
It perfectly encapsulates the entire thesis of the track. It is a total tragic breakdown in communication.
Mm-hmm.
Harmonically, the two voices sound beautiful together, but narratively, they are singing completely past each other.
They are occupying the exact same acoustic space, but they aren't in the same conversation.
Precisely. The ringing of his metaphorical tinnitus, his need to run, to drink, to talk to strangers, to generate constant distraction. It's so loud that it has completely drowned out her offer of sanctuary.
She's right there.
She is standing right in front of him, offering the exact cure he needs. Come on home, let my love keep you safe. And he's just squeezing his eyes shut, hands over his ears, screaming not to be stopped. He literally cannot hear her over the noise of his own defense mechanisms.
Wow. So as we pull back from this lyrical breakdown, let's look at the emotional landscape we've traversed today. We started in this claustrophobic, haunted town full of environmental triggers where, you know, memories attach themselves to the flagstones.
Right, the ghosts.
And we explored the brilliant mechanics of the tinnitus metaphor, how phantom noise isolates us and forces us to keep running just to avoid the silence. And we watched this heartbreaking dynamic unfold where a partner attempts to disarm a man's foolish pride, only to be ground out by his need for performative, counterfeit vulnerability.
It really operates more like a clinical character study than a standard pop song.
It really does.
It forces us to examine our own cognitive dissonance. I mean, what is our personal tinnitus? How do we manufacture noise and distraction in our own lives, whether it's overworking, doom scrolling, or talking to strangers, just to avoid the quiet, terrifying work of actually being accountable to the people we love?
That is the power of a truly great song. It stops being about the artist's specific Tuesday night at the Gunner and starts being a mirror held up to our own messy human behavior.
And, you know, the structure of the song leaves us with a rather haunting, unresolved question.
What's that?
If his memories ring like tinnitus, and if stopping his frantic momentum only brings him pain, does the fact that the song loops back into the same frantic chorus at the end imply he is doomed to keep running forever?
Oh, wow.
If he never stops to pull the car over and pop the hood, does the ringing ever actually fade? Or is he actively, permanently choosing the noise over the cure?
Choosing the noise over the cure. That is a heavy, lingering thought to leave on. I want you to keep that dynamic in mind next time you find yourself turning the metaphorical radio up instead of having the difficult conversation you know you need to have.
Good advice.
I highly encourage you to go listen to Rein Me In again right now with all of these psychological mechanics echoing in your ears. See if you hear those overlapping vocals differently. Thanks for exploring the muddy waters with us on your deep dive today, and we'll catch you next time.